Our scripture reading for this morning will be from the Old Testament book, Lamentation. Lamentations, chapter 1, beginning with verse 1, and I'll be reading from the New American Standard Bible. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. She has become like a widow who was once great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a forced laborer. She weeps bitterly in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. She has none to comfort her. Among all her lovers, all her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile under affliction and under harsh servitude. She dwells among the nations, but she has found no rest. All her pursuers have overtaken her in the midst of distress. The roads of Zion are in mourning because no one comes to the appointed feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests are groaning. Her virgins are afflicted. And she herself is bitter. Her adversaries have become her masters. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord has caused her grief because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her little ones have gone away as captives before the adversary. All her majesty has departed from the daughter of Zion. Her princes have become like deer. They have found no pasture, and they have fled without strength before the pursuer. Just such an upbeat book, isn't it? We had in our reading the entire book of Lamentations. I encouraged you to read all five chapters. And knowing that the title of the book means to weep or to lament, you can't hardly expect an upbeat message. But this particular book is designed to be read annually in the Jewish faith. There was a certain day of the month that on the ninth day of that month, the very time that they believed not only Solomon's temple fell, but also Herod's temple in A.D. 70. And the Jews keep records of those things better than most of us. They would stand before the congregation and read the book of Lamentation. It might surprise you to know that this book is a book of poetry. It's as if someone wrote a ballad. It has five chapters, and all but one of them contain 22 verses, which is the number of the Hebrew alphabet. The one chapter that doesn't contain 22 contains three times 22, 66 verses. Chapter 3 is the longest. In each of these chapters, there's either three lines per verse, two lines per verse, or as in the final chapter, chapter 5, which is, does have 22 verses, only one line per verse. Some of them are acrostics, where they actually begin with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet and change as it goes down between verse to verse. But you see the symmetry and the design. And what it is meant to be is a remembrance, not necessarily a celebration, but a remembrance of what it is when God's people fail to focus as they should. When their priorities get messed up, when God is left out, what happens to a nation? I want you to hold that thought in mind throughout the lesson. When God is left out, what happens to a nation? Have you ever been abandoned? What's it like to be alone, deserted by the ones you love? Without support, for assistance. Bereft of companionship, desolate, empty, discarded. Forsaken, forlorn, and friendless. Jettisoned. Isolated. Outcast. Rejected, renounced, and relinquished. Shunted. Sidelined and solitary, uncared for and God forsaken. You say, man, talk about depressing. The title of my lesson this morning is Deserted. What is it like to be deserted? It's impossible to read the book of Lamentations and not see a city in rubble. And that's what we want to picture this morning, is that the prophet Jeremiah, probably penning this book just shortly after the final destruction of Jerusalem, is walking its streets. And he says, how lonely sits the city that was once full of people. And so we not only see a city where there's rubble everywhere. You can imagine maybe the smoke from some fires if he's on the scene rather quickly after it takes place. It's probably littered with corpses. We're going to read the entire chapter of chapter 5. It's the shortest of the bunch, but toward the end of the lesson, we will read the entire chapter. And the poetry, the symmetry, the visualness of the chapter is just overwhelming. It's a war zone. And it's where the inhabitants have been defeated. It's not that they're all dead, but if you noticed as we read through the last chapter of Jeremiah in chapter 52, he gave the numbers of the people that were carried away into captivity. Certainly there are people left that escaped to the hills and returned to Jerusalem and then flee to Egypt with Jeremiah and his scribe Baruch. But most of the people, I would say the majority of the people, die. Because only less than 5,000, look, read it, it's in the last chapter, Jeremiah chapter 52, less than 5,000 are carried away into captivity. Do you remember how many came out of the land of Egypt? 600,000 fighting men came out of the land of Egypt. Imagine what a loss this is. Now we know the 10 tribes to the north were desecrated 100 years earlier. And so we do just have two small tribes and a portion of the Levites, Judah and Benjamin and the Levites left. But only 5,000, less than 5,000 are carried away into captivity. So probably the slain are everywhere. How lonely sits the city that was once full of people. Let's look at three passages very quickly that show that Jeremiah has earned the title of being a weeping prophet. In chapter 1, verse 16. Chapter 1, verse 16. For these things I weep. My eyes run down with water, because far from me is a comforter, one who restores my soul. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. Chapter 2, verse 11. My eyes fail because of tears. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is poured out on the earth because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, when little ones and infants faint in the streets of the city. And then finally in chapter 3, verses 48 and 49. My eyes run down with streams of water because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. My eyes pour down unceasingly without stopping. Now we can clearly see why Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. I want to come back to these verses in just a minute. But let me ask you something. Why isn't this an opportunity of vindication rather than of weeping for Jeremiah? As he looks upon this rubble, why doesn't it surge through his heart? This is what I proclaimed. that Babylon would be the cauldron poured out from the north. That's how he starts his book in Jeremiah chapter 1. The 70 years of captivity have begun just like I said they would, that you would be carried away and your kings would be deposed. Why doesn't he stand up with a loud voice and cry out and say, I told you so? Why is he crying? Why is he weeping? The answer is simple, isn't it? Because he's God's man. And Jeremiah has been transformed from a man who said, get somebody else, I'm too young, to nearly 40 years later at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, not only seeing with the eyes of God, but having the heart of God. He cries because he loves and because he cares. That's what your daddy used to always say, or your mom just before they punished you. This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. And you said, yeah, right. No, you didn't say that. You just thought it because you knew there were going to be more stripes laid if you said it. Jeremiah has become exactly what God knew that he could and would become. His man. You say, well, that's the way all men of God are. No, you forget one in particular. His name was Jonah. You remember him? He proclaimed a message, and then what did he do? He sat up on the ridge and he looked down on the city of Nineveh and he waited for what? Did he want the people to repent? No. Even after they did repent, was he happy? No. He sat there waiting to see the destruction of Nineveh personally. And God had to chastise him. There was a man of God who wanted to say, I told you so. And instead the people listened and he was distraught. He spoke the words of God, but he did not have his heart, nor did he see as God sees. I think Jonah had some problems, don't you? And I'm not sure where he died in the sense of his relationship with the Lord. He started out challenging God, and though he did God's bidding, he did it almost unwillingly. And then in the end, he still did not have the mind of God to see as he saw. But that's not the case with Jeremiah. And so we see that as he walks these streets, he is crying. But there's more going on here. He is weeping because God, too, is weeping. We read those three passages, but if you look back now and go back to verse 16 of chapter 1, in the context, and I'm not going to read it again, but I'd like for you to after I tell you this, that is Jerusalem weeping in verse 16 of chapter 1. Now read it again for yourself, but this time personify the spirit of Jerusalem that lies in rubble with smoke rising and strewn with corpses, and read verse 16 to yourself. In chapter 2, verse 11, you put that into context, and again, it's not necessarily Jeremiah weeping. Chapter 2, verse 11, it's God's lament. In chapter 2, verse 11, read that again, and this time understand that the possibility is there, the very real contextual possibility, that this is God who is in tears. Only in chapter 3, verses 48 and 49, do we think that for sure, my eyes run down with streams of water because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, that these words represent Jeremiah's crying. And so as you look at Lamentation, the poem or the ballad of weeping or mourning, and you see that what the writer has actually done is to show us that everyone involved in the story is in tears. Well, that happened sometimes as a parent and when you corrected, didn't it? Everyone involved was in tears. After the punishment, your child was crying, but so were you. Here we have Jerusalem crying, God crying, Jeremiah crying. And I think what we've got to take from this is not a happy occasion. And you say, duh, really? sin and its consequences, unrepented of, destroy all the potential, all the promise, all the good. Because the wages of sin is death. And if you can connect this ballad to Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 6, verse 23, that the wages of sin is death, then it becomes real. It becomes alive. Jerusalem today is a bustling city. Colleen and I got to walk the crowded streets where we didn't always feel the safest. But it's because you're in a foreign culture, for the most part, and you're surrounded by people who don't dress or talk like you. And they're shouting at you as best they can in English, but it doesn't quite come off as English, as they want you to come over and look at the vegetables or their wares or to buy this or that. There is not as much, but there is still some raw meat hanging along the street. Now they've put most of it behind coolers, so it's not out in the open attracting flies. And the grocery carts, or the way that they transport from one booth to the next, are these small tractors that just fit in the middle of the street, and you have to step aside to watch them rumble by pulling their carts of wares. Why am I telling you all of that? Because I can easily visualize Jerusalem without a person. I can see the streets in rubble. I can see the stones of the buildings tumbled down and the dust rising from them. The streets are narrow where we were in the old city of Jerusalem, not too far from the temple. And they wind incessantly. You best have a guide. Except for the Via Della Rosa. What's the name of that street? The Road of Pain. Via Della Rosa. And it starts from the north part of the temple and goes to the Holy Sepulchre. And it's the way that they believe that Jesus carried his cross, if he was truly crucified on the western side of the city. But perhaps the Via Della Rosa really isn't reality, that he was crucified not far, because what they believe to be Mount Calvary today is exactly on the north side of the temple grounds. And the tomb, very real possibility, the tomb is but a stone's throw from the place of the skull. We got to visit both. If you ever get the chance to do that, and it's peaceful enough that you feel safe in doing that in our lifetime, you need to go. You need to go. Not that it's the Holy Land, but it is that which makes things real. When you partake of the Lord's Supper, you visualize the cross, you almost witness the resurrection. Such a history. A pile of rubble. The temple destroyed, desecrated, the walls torn down. There's no one sitting on the porches. There's no sound of music. There's no wedding procession. Those are the images that Jeremiah gave to us as he lamented. That which should hold such fullness and promise of people going and bustling about in commerce, of priests walking the street, of pilgrims coming in to celebrate the feast, of the very live rituals of animal sacrifice so that God's people might continue to walk with Him in holiness. It's all gone. What would be your term? Deserted, certainly. Abandoned, rejected, relinquished. But what comes to my mind as well? Wasted. What a waste. They were to be the light on the hill. What are they now? There is no life, so it's darkness. They were to be a testimony to the nations. The lament of Jeremiah is all that which God had planned from the time that He gave His promise to Abraham. It all seems to be for naught. A nation of millions has been reduced to 5,000 and they're gone. They haven't abandoned the street. They have been taken prisoners to a faraway country called Babylon to be there for sure for 7 decades long. You know what else Jeremiah knows as he stands there in 586? He'll never see it any different. For him, 70 years is beyond his lifetime. He's probably, if he started at age 20, and we are at least 40 plus years into his ministry, we don't know for sure as far as what age, but he said, I am but a youth. He's at least in his mid-60s at this time. They won't come back for 70 years. We don't have any record of Jeremiah surviving in the book until the time that it's all renewed. And so as he stands there and he looks at this, certainly he can feel vindication that what he said was true. But what he has said about this people is lasting for 7 decades, 70 years. And yet he's got a deed to a piece of property that is worthless, isn't it? Why did God have him do that? You buy that deed from your cousin. I command you. And then you write it down and you record it and you hide it away in an urn so that it will be kept safe. Do you think we'll ever find the deed of Jeremiah? I would think that would be so neat. If somewhere somebody digs a foundation for a house or discovers another cave in the area and finds that urn that has the plot of land that Jeremiah bought. Why did God have him do it? Because God said it won't always be this way. There will come a day when once again my people will rejoice in their homeland. We know that begins to transpire during the time of Daniel. We're going to get to Ezekiel and Daniel. But next week in our reading, we're going to read the book of 1 Peter, and our reading says not to read chapter 5. I'm going to encourage you to read all 5 chapters of 1 Peter before next week because I want to pull a lesson from all over the place when we do that. And chapter 5 is pretty important. So read all of 1 Peter for next week, and then we'll be back to the Old Testament, and we'll begin to study the prophecy of one of those captives in Babylon. His name is Ezekiel. Carried away as a young man along with Daniel. And we'll be reading those and seeing what God is saying to his people while they are surrounded by the enemy. Jeremiah, what would you have us learn? Let's go to chapter 5. Remember, 22 verses, but this time just one line per verse. Do your best. If you need to close your eyes and just listen, fine. But do your best to be a director of a video, a cinematography event where you are having to set up these scenes. And what you have here is a script of Jeremiah as he walks the streets. Remember, O Lord, what has fallen us. Look and see our reproach. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens. We have become orphans without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We have to pay for our drinking water. Our wood comes to us at a price. Our pursuers are at our necks. We are worn out. There is no rest for us. We have submitted to Egypt and to Assyria to get enough bread. Our fathers sinned and are no more. It is we who have borne their iniquities. Slaves rule over us. There is no one to deliver us from their hand. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. Our skin has become as hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine. They ravished the women in Zion, the virgins in the cities of Judah. Princes were hung by their hands. Elders were not respected. Young men worked at the grinding mill, and youths stumbled under the loads of wood. Elders are gone from the gate, young men from their music. The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes are dim. Because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate. Foxes prowl in it. You, O Lord, rule forever. Your throne is from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. I think that's a rhetorical question. I think there is no doubt that God is exceedingly angry with them. But what do you hear in the words of Jeremiah? In the midst of it all, he feels the pain. Jesus said, simply weep with those that weep and rejoice with those that rejoice. He's not gloating. He is exceedingly sorrowful. And what is he crying out? Lord, have mercy. Have you ever said those words? Prayed that prayer? Oh, Lord, please, don't desert me. But in reality, God's love has been steadfast. There is a small set of passages or scriptures here in Jeremiah that I hope you saw as you read it. Turn with me to chapter 3 and look again, beginning with verse 22. You say, how can you say God's love is permanent and he is steadfast when all around is but destruction? The Hebrew writer, whomever he is, says it simply in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 12. The Lord chastens him whom he loves, as a father scourges his son in whom he delights. If you don't have Hebrews chapter 6, verse 12 side noted somewhere, then put it here close to these passages that we're about to read, and then we're going to sing them. That discipline is an act of love. What do we call it today? Tough love. It's not a concept that is popular, but it's biblical and it's godly. Because God knows the very point of having parents, and especially a father, is so that the son can understand the right way. In fact, the Hebrew writer goes on to say, if a son is not disciplined by his father, he might as well not have had a father at all. And you tell me what a nation's like without fathers in the home. God says, and if they're in the home, they need to be disciplinarians. That's not very popular. Do you think? It's a whole lot easier to be milquetoast, to just let things go by. But that's what the leaders of the children of Judah have done. The priests, the prophets, aside from Jeremiah and those other ones that we'll study later as we get to the minor prophets. And the king, they've not called people back to God. In fact, they've made up excuses. And so out of his love, God has to deliver on his word. If you will not give me the credit for your blessings, then you shall have my curses. If you haven't read Deuteronomy chapter 28 in a while, if you want to read the blessings, start with verse 1. If you want to read just the curses, start with verse 15. But read sometime again, Deuteronomy 28. God says, you walk with me, and it's going to be great. You depart from me, and how lonely sits the city that was once full of people. She has become like a widow. Some versions read, the queen has become a bond slave. How our crown has fallen, Jeremiah said here. But now let's read this oracle of hope. Look at verse 22. It seems so out of place almost. Chapter 3, the Lord's loving kindness indeed never cease. His kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in him. Hymn number 368. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new. You say, man, that seems out of place for such a book. Not with Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 12. In parenting, it's better not to have a rule than to have a rule and not enforce it. Don't say you can't if you're not going to back it up. And don't make a promise that you're not going to fulfill. But in the grand scheme of things, as God there in Deuteronomy chapter 28 says, you walk with me and these are your blessings. You reject me and these are your cursing. He was a father laying down the law. But we've already seen that it wasn't just Jerusalem weeping when punishment came. It wasn't just Jeremiah crying because his family had been carried away captive or slain. God himself had eyes full of tears. And so should it be. Not a vindictive, a joyful punishment, but that which brings sadness, but nonetheless has to be done. I can hear the father saying to his son, you've left me no choice. Else what do you have? Without correction, chaos. No standard. No God. May we be chastened. May we look closely at the examples that we have in the Old Testament, because they are for our learning, that we through patience and wisdom of the Scriptures or encouragement of the Scriptures might have hope. I pray on the last day that the tears in God's eyes as He looks at me are tears of joy as He calls His Son home. That's what God desires as we stand and as we sing.